Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose. Rose Colombo right here for you every Wednesday from 12 to 1 p.m. on the West Coast. And we have a beautiful day today. It is sunny. Thank God for that. Good old vitamin D. And today we have a fabulous guest as well. I'm sure that everyone has the family that they are concerned about and love, and the traditional family. And we all would love to see the traditional family remain intact, because the family is the foundation of a civilized nation. Remember that. The family is the foundation of a civilized nation. And today we have a very special guest. He actually is a returning guest, and his name is G.L. Gooding. And you may remember him, wonderful books that he's shared with us in the past. Fresh Snow on Bedford Falls, It's a Wonderful Life That Ends as George Bailey Answers to an Inquisitive Bank Examiner About the Money That Is Still Missing. And then there's Murder in Minnesota, follows a young Vietnam veteran who strikes out on a cross-country adventure with his friends and uncovers a string of startling murder. But now he's has a new novel hot off the press, Where Courage Began. It's hailed by Midwest Book Review as impressively written. Where Courage Began shines real light on the Depression-era Midwest and the valuable traditions of family and friendship that are still evident across the state of Iowa today. Award-winning author G.L. Gooding masterfully follows the real-life story of his mother and effectively captures the essence of her upbeat, indomitable spirit, a timeless model for facing and overcoming life's hardships even today. And, you know, this is a timely story because, you know, the farmers are having such a tough time since the lockdowns, and many of them had to dump the milk, the eggs, the crops, and that is a very painful part of this tragic situation of this pandemic. And so these farmers killed 200,000 chickens, and they killed, they dumped the eggs, and they had to get rid of and slaughter some of the pigs and the cows and so forth. So it is a very serious problem in America, and the story is very timely. Where Courage Began. Let me tell you a little bit about the author. The American novelist G.L. Gooding is the author of Where Courage Began and other based on real-life novels in in the Velma story series. Gooding has written three other compelling books that I mentioned, and they had a glowing review in the industry. And also I wanted to mention that he was hailed by the Midwest Book Review as impressively written, Where Courage Began, and that's a real honor. So let me tell you a little bit about the book before he joins us. Velma was only 5 years old when she and her sister were left in charge of their baby brothers in a raging blizzard. Her father was dying in the other room, and her mother was willing to battle severe snowstorms to seek the help that might save them. And I'm going to let him tell you the rest of the story. So we're going to take a break, and we will be back when we enter into the wonderful world of authors and experts.
Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite. Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Yes, it's Columbo Chronicles Live, and listen up. And I think we got a double slice of that homemade apple pie on the Horseshoe Cafe. So we are going to listen up because we're entering into the world of authors and experts. And this is a really special book. It's based on the early life of author G. L. Gooding's mother, Where Courage Began, tells the story of Velma, her three siblings, and her widowed mother, Alice Steele. So why don't we just get started, and let's welcome G. L. Gooding, and I'm going to call him Gary, but his book name is G. L. Gooding, and let's just say hello. Hi there, Gary. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you for having me. Nice to be back with you.
It's great to hear your voice, and we're so excited you have this new novel, hot off the press, Where Courage Began, and it's very timely. I was explaining to the audience at the beginning of the show, because traditional family is so important, and the farmers are so important, and through all of the challenges we're having today, it just seems like it's kind of warm and cozy and also encouraging and empowering to listen to a story about a traditional family, not only their struggles, but their victory. So, Gary, let me ask you, you have written books before that are of human
yes.
interest. And what made you decide to write a book about your mother?
Well, it all started when I gave her my first novel on her 100th birthday after promising for years that I was going to write a novel. And I have to say it was both a blessing and a running joke, because when she read it, every time I talked to her on the phone, she would say that I'm really enjoying this book, but I can't believe you wrote it. So that was a little bit disconcerting. But while I was visiting her during that time, I was reminded of how often I'd visited her and sat with her. Her mind was sharp all until she passed at 102. But she had a better mind than most of us in the family. She was the repository of all knowledge for our family. And I would sit there and ask her. I thought, well, instead of just hearing the same stories over and over, I'll start asking her curious questions or interesting questions like, so what's your first vivid memory as a child growing up on a farm? And that's when she launched into the story I'd never heard about, watching her father on the living room sofa while she and her 7-year-old sister watched their toddler and infant brothers, and her mother went out in a snowstorm for help. And I was blown away by the casual offhand way that she presented that story. And I notched that in my head and decided, after finally being successful in completing my first novel, that and having a couple others in the work that I think we talked about a year or so ago, I thought, well, you know, I should honor not only my mother, but the people of Iowa and the people of the Midwest and the farming communities, the rural communities, who back 100 years ago knew what struggle, art, and hardship was, and how important it was to have family support and community support. And so I began to lace together many of the stories that she had given me. Unfortunately, I started the process too late to make it this biography. So I turned it into a novel in which she, her stories and her life are an integral part of the story, and weaves in a lot of the life and texture of central Iowa, where she was born and spent her early years. And by the time I got finished with drafting the story, I found I had two books. So you're in possession of book one of what I hope to be a series of four books, a quartet of books about her life, because she had a great foundation, and it led to some amazing accomplishments for a woman with her humble beginnings.
Yes, I think it's really interesting because, you know, what you grasp, because when you go back and you hear the stories of your parents or your grandparents, I was so impressed as well, because these people in hard times, you know, they still survive. They beat the challenges of life and farms during drought and storms and snowstorms and flooding and whatever. It's amazing what they accomplished. So you were hailed by Midwest Book Review as impressively written, compulsive page-turning from beginning to end. That is a wonderful, wonderful review. And
yes,
so,
I was very happy to get that.
Yes, and so and you should be, and proud of that. And so your mom was, her life was began in the 1920s, and so you have a dramatic opening, which you explained to us in the beginning, but why is Velma the focal point and an important part in your family's survival? And who is Velma?
Velma is my mother. Velma was born in 1916 in the middle of the First World War, and survived the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918-1919. And the book opens just after she turned five. And she was proud to say how, and was proud to say that a farm life, you didn't get a lot of play time. You got a lot of chore time. And she was doing things to help out there with her parents. And part of the story in the novel is why they were kind of, not kind of, they were isolated from their larger families on both sides because of religious differences. So they were basically an island unto themselves and couldn't rely on the large family. My grandmother was one of 11 children. My grandfather was one of nine. My grandparents were basically left alone to run this farm. And so as soon as my mother's sister, Wilma, was old enough, she started helping out, and so did my mother. And they learned a lot of skills from my grandmother because they had to have, they couldn't have a single job. In those days, there weren't employers running ads for a lot of people with job openings. And my grandmother had the basic skills that she passed on to her children of cooking, baking, sewing, washing, mending, and she turned those into a life of that they were able to survive on thanks to pulling together. And my mother was really an extraordinary part of that. She was, I would say, was the most she was old for her age, whatever age it was. She was very mature, very intuitive, and very thoughtful in her life, all through her life. And many of the stories that I heard from her and also from my older siblings and from family members as I sat around the dining table reinforced that. So I'm trying to convey a very capable, very intuitive, very precocious child who was always looking beyond herself.
And always looking beyond herself, and she had a love for God, the land, hard work, and her family and friendship. So that made her a whole person, basically, and she appeared to be very giving. And as well as hardworking, but they also went. She also went through the Great Depression. How did they survive the Great Depression?
Well, I was one of the interesting things I discovered in doing my research is the Great Depression for farmers and rural communities started in 1919, not 1929, because all many of the farmers in the rural areas had rented land, rented property, bought land to produce produce and product for the war effort. And they got overextended, and then this war came to a sudden and abrupt end, and the foreclosures began in earnest. And so that was the time in which my mother began her life and began at the level where she was understanding what was going on. And frankly, the fact that that they were struggling to keep their farm probably led to her father's death. He was 32 years old when he passed away that night in the living room of their farmhouse. So they moved to the city of the town. I call it a city, a town, a small town of Woodward, which was the smallest community. And they were able to rent an apartment above a hardware store where that thankfully had a very large kitchen. When my grandmother, who was an accomplished baker, had won awards at various county fairs for her pies and especially her cinnamon rolls, which were her specialty. And so she started baking things and had made, thankfully, through God's good graces, had met and established a friendship with a local mercantile owner and his wife, and they began carrying her products in their store. And then there were a few small eating establishments there that began to use her baked goods on their menu. But of course, that wasn't enough, so she then took in laundry washing, which the girls helped. My mother used to joke, she was always cold-blooded, and she didn't mind being in 100-plus degree heat doing the laundry during the summer, but she hated January and February because it was brutal washing, taking a laundry that they'd taken in. My grandmother was a seamstress. She taught her daughters. They made all her clothes. They sold clothes. And then they also found a few homes for the more affluent in the community and did house cleaning. So they did a variety of things. And my mother and her sister would come home after school and immediately start helping their mother, and usually often fell asleep before they could finish their homework because they were so exhausted. But they couldn't outdo their mother, who was up at 4 in the morning and went to bed after, well after the kids were in bed. And as you read in the book, she had a break because of that. And again, through the graciousness of the community and help of friends, they weathered that storm and slowly but surely became a fixture in the community.
Well, what's amazing is that these stories, you know, such as the story about your mother, is so empowering and enlightening, because we forget that their life was very basic. I mean, people did not get up and put on a suit and go to work, or catch a bus, or jump in a car and go to work. And, you know, so they had to be self-sufficient, and they had to be a traditional family, and they had to work together and pull together in order to survive. And it's amazing how they did that even through a depression, no matter how rough it got, through bad weather, snowstorms, and so forth. And yet, you know, you compare it to today, and people are in fear of having to do any of that today and go back to basics, and because of what is happening with the economy and everything else. So I think it's really important to have these stories that, yes, human beings can survive, even women who lose their husbands, which is an important part of the family unit, and very important part to the family unit. Yeah. And yet your mother took on the role of being both mother and father too, right?
Right. My grandmother was a very strong woman. I had several years being around her, and she was a very stoic and not a very warm and loving person. And it wasn't until I got into the stories behind the trials and tribulations that it, you know, when you're widowed in your late 20s with four children and no education beyond the farm and beyond the skills you learned growing up in that kind of environment, and you're expected now to take care of them. Remember, this is the 20s. There was no safety net. There was no Social Security. There was no disability insurance. There was nothing. It was, you relied on yourself, your family, and your community to survive. And even at that, it was very, very, very challenging. And one of the reasons I wrote this book, besides to honor my mother, who was an extraordinary woman, but was to recognize how many extraordinary women and men there were at that time, because you were it. You were the island. You couldn't turn around and hold a hand out and expect to get something. You would probably just meet another hand being held out because they have their own challenges to meet. And so It was a labor of love and a labor of hopefully people will read this book and get some perspective on what it's like to live now versus when it was truly a hand-to-mouth kind of environment.
Exactly, and I think that's what's so important to write these stories such as you've done, because I think it's important to look at the past and basics and traditional family and how people came to help each other in neighborhoods. Well, they didn't have, a lot of them didn't have neighborhoods because they lived in rural farms, but people still heard somehow, you know, that someone needed help or somebody would stop by, ask if they needed help. Whereas today, even though we live in communities that are next door to each other or on top of each other and so forth, people don't know each other and they don't even say hello and they don't bother to introduce themselves and they don't bother to ask their neighbors across this country. And a lot of big cities, you know, do you need anything? Can I help you? I'm going to the store. Whereas when you and I were growing up, they did that. They still did that. I remember in our neighborhood, the ladies would stop by and ask my mom, I'm going to the store. Do you need anything? Do you want me to watch your kids? Do you have to go to the store? I mean, it was a totally different situation since 2000. And it's getting more isolated. And I'm so happy you wrote Where Courage Began, because I love hearing these stories of how strong women were in those times, in the 20s and during the Depression. It's very important to know that, yes, we can be strong and we can use our survival skills and we can pick ourselves up and move on, right?
Right, and I would be remiss if I didn't say how important part in those days the church played in the community in keeping people connected and bringing them together to in moments of crisis for families in need, those people that were in need and got the help would become the next group that were the helpers for those people that were in need. And it was very much the communities working together and relying on each other, and there wasn't a lot of places to turn except to your fellow man. And in those days, it seemed second nature to just be there ready to help and ready to reach out, because you knew today it's somebody else, tomorrow could be me.
Oh, that was very well said. And so are you working on your second novel now?
My second novel in this series is out. It's either out or it's coming out. I can't remember where we stand exactly, but it continues the saga of my mother's and family life, picking up where the first book left off. And I called it The Road to Resilience, where my mother and her family had to relocate from Woodward and move to a new location and start over again. And it's also a love story because it talks about my mother meeting my father. And I tell you, that was a lot of fun because my mother gave me the framework or the bare bones of how of their relationship, which was, I found, quite refreshing and a lot of humor in it. And I got to flesh it out. I got to, unfortunately, she passed away before this book came out. I would have loved to have gotten her reaction to how I wrote their meeting and how her brother, my mother was a very beautiful woman, and she had suitors. And she was had actually somebody who thought they were her fiancé. And then in a matter of a few weeks, my father stepped into the picture and swept her off her feet. And for a while, he had to lay low because my mother's brother and her fiance, or who thought he was her fiance, were out to get him. It was a true adventure, and I smiled a lot when I was writing that, because I was I would sit with my mother for hours, kind of fleshing these things out and asking her details so I could, you know, write notes and capture it more in more detail. And so it was great fun. So the next book revolves around the same area in Iowa, but includes a move to Perry, so that, which was a bigger town where they could had a better chance to make a living with the Depression hard on. And so that book is finished, and I think it's now available online. I think both books are out there. Where Courage Began and The Road to Resilience. And my third book is in the series is a quarter of the way into that, and it tells an odyssey during World War II and beyond. So I'm having a lot of fun with
great.
That, and obviously being productive in the writing.
You've
department.
Been very productive to talk to you. I mean, that's a lot of work that you put into this, and a lot of research, and it's you know, I commend you for it. And it's interesting to me that one of the statements you made was the sweet aroma of Ellis Steele's cinnamon rolls is one of the most comforting reminders of the community's traditional values. And that just goes back to show how homemade food was like war, you know, it was like an invitation when you walked into someone's home of warmth and love and made people feel comfortable. And because, you know, back in the day before 2000 with all the fast foods and everything, that's the way it was. You walked into grandma's house and there was the aroma of something good cooking on the stove.
Yes.
So that reminded me of that as well when I walked in my grandma's house.
And the other part go ahead, I'm sorry. I was just going to say the other part of that is the amazing things, how long my mother could make food last in the house. It seemed like a pound of ground beef lasted the entire week and was in all of these sumptuous sauces, and you know, of course, potatoes were cheap, so you always had potatoes. And I mean, mm-hmm. we were a household when in my as I grew up with two older brothers, myself and my dad and my grandmother living together, and that's a lot of people to feed. And my mother was a magician, not only with the baking and the smells that would be so wonderful, but just stretching food and making it taste good. So I think that's a generational thing that I'm sure you can probably relate to, and many in your audience can as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, because, you know, they knew, you know, that they didn't want to waste food. I remember, you know, my mother always saying, "You have to finish your dinner." We go, "Why? We're full." And, "Well, there's starving kids in Africa." I'm like, "What's that got to do with us?"
Yeah, right. take a country. There was somebody
food.
Starving. Right.
Yeah, there was
somebody
always
starving somewhere.
So, you're supposed to overeat to compensate.
I know. But I have to admit, I never got to like liver. I emptied the mustard jar on my liver, but we did have that as well, and you probably did. So anyway, it has been a real joy writing these books and revisiting and continuing on with the saga. I'm looking forward to, I haven't even arrived yet. The real star of the show hasn't even arrived. I'm still a twinkle in my parents' eyes. So I'm really enjoying writing these books. It warms my heart. It takes me back to simpler times and then times when reliance on the people around you, in your family, your friends, your church, were so much more important, that taking care of each other was a local thing, not a national thing, where somebody who didn't have any idea who you were was making the decisions about what you got or didn't get. So it's
and
been,
we didn't have Big
been,
Brother. Yeah, and we didn't have Big Brother taking care of us. We took care of ourselves and each
right.
other.
So,
I agree with you 100%. It was great to be able to be free and liberated and be able to use your skills and abilities like your mother did and my grandparents and so forth. And my, you know, it was passed on to my parents and just generational, like you said. And but we're losing all of that. So I'm happy you wrote Where Courage Began and by G.L. Gooding. And now's your time to shine, G.L. Gooding. And tell us any message you like and also where they can purchase your books and if you have any contact information you'd like to share.
Well, I'd encourage everyone to go to glgooding.com. That's my webpage, and it'll cover all of my books that I've written. I'm now working on book 6 and book 7, so I've made a lot of progress since we first talked around Fresh Snow on Bedford Falls, my first book. So I have truly enjoyed bringing my mother's story to the books, and I think there's, as we've already discussed, a lot of value in the history of those books. There's a lot of, I learned a lot just in doing the research for the books. For example, that the Depression for Iowa farmers started a decade before the Great Depression was hit the nation, and I just encourage people to find books, mine or other books, that they can bring them joy and revisit the values that make us warm, make us feel good about humans, the human nature, and encourage the self-reliance that our parents and our grandparents lived and worked hard to try. Ironically, in a way, they did us a disservice because they worked so hard so we wouldn't have to suffer the way they suffered. And now it seems that there are too many people out there that just don't understand the value in hard work and the value in community, nearby community, and church, and having a connection to a higher being, because it's really lonely out there if you wipe out everything else and there's no one to turn to give you strength and give you hope and give you support. And I will continue to write. I've got 4 books in the series about my mother, who had an incredible life beyond her early childhood, amazing things that I think that she accomplished, as well as many in that generation. And so I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you again. It's been a while, and I've got other books in there. I encourage you and others to get the second in the Velma series, which is the Road to Resilience. No, I've got alliterations in here. I guess that's my strong suit. My murder mystery is Murder in Minnesota, and my second murder mystery is Felony in Florida. So I guess that's my signature, is to play with words. But anyway, it's always a delight to talk to you and spend time with your audience, and I appreciate the exposure, and I hope people will reach out to my website and look at all of the offerings. That's quite a variety. Somebody told me after I started writing the variety that maybe I should have stuck to one genre, but you know, I'm I'm old enough now, I better get what is in my head out before it's too late. I can't.
That's how I feel too. You might as well just write whatever you feel like writing. It's, you know, it's an individual choice, right?
that's right. And hopefully if they like one book that you wrote, they'll take the time to check out others and find a change of pace, which
that's
is fine. What I've enjoyed is each of my books has a different flavor to it. And that keeps me stimulated, fresh, and writing. So thank you
exactly.
again for having me on, and I hope we do it again really soon.
We will, and I hope you have a blessed day. And G.L. Goody, much success with your books, Where Courage Began, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And G.L. Gooding has left the building, and I hope you'll get his book, Where Courage Began. It's really a warm and wonderful book, and you won't be, it is a page-turner. You won't want to put it down. And so go to his website and find it, www, and his name is G.L. Gooding. And on that note, we're going to take a break. And we're going to come back and we're going to enter into the world of politics, and we will be important message on Columbo Chronicles Live.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
That's right. Be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe. And now we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts on Columbo Chronicles. And I discussed a little bit about an article called Silicon Alley, and it's inside the Taiwan firm that makes the world's tech run. It's written by Charlie Campbell on Time Magazine. It's very, very timely. And I wanted to talk about the semiconductor chip shortages. It's going to affect our lives. It's going to affect our country. It's going to affect you. It's going to affect me. It's going to affect the businesses, our jobs, our communication, our military, our medical devices. You name it, it is going to affect it, because unfortunately, globalism was not a great idea, in my opinion. It never was. I never agreed with it. And neither was opening the borders. And the reason to open the borders is because they want to create a globalist world and all of the sovereign nations and pretend that we're all one. We are not all one. We're all unique. We're all unique to our homeland. We're all unique to our ethnicity, to our races. We may apply for citizenship in other countries legally, but that doesn't mean we don't love our homeland. It means that many people come to developed countries such as America or Canada in order to seek out better opportunities and escape tyranny or communism or the Muslim Brotherhood's tyrannical ideologies that deny most women and children's rights, along with communism. And they don't believe in the God of the Judeo-Christian nations, or the Bible, or Jesus Christ. And so it is totally different. We are not all the same. We all are human beings, and we all have our human emotions and needs and thoughts and so forth, but civilizations are all different, which makes us unique, so we can learn about those civilizations. They can learn about our country and our civilization, and that's what makes the world go round, and that's what makes us so unique, to go visit different countries and to be able to visit the different races, the different ethnicities, the different cultures, foods, clothing, way of life. It's exciting and it's fun. And then there's the countries that maybe we can help, and which America has always done. But we are not one world as far as sovereign nations. We don't have the same laws. We don't have the same thoughts about our laws as about everybody else's laws, even though there are foreigners who come into our country and try to change our laws into their laws and transform our way of life into their way of life. So if we wanted to be transformed and changed, we would move to their countries. But they're moving to our countries to live in our country, and yet they don't want to assimilate, and they don't want to be an American. They want to come here many times, infiltrate, and steal our country so they can change and transform it into their country, whether it's communism or radicalism, whatever their thing is. We do not want to be changed or transformed. And that was started with the Clintons. Well, actually went back to the Bushes, because they were in bed with the CFR, who enacted the North American Union, which is the open border policy in America, and that's when it began. And the pandemic began with the Bushes in 2004. It appears that Bill Gates was involved with all presidents and began this pandemic way back when. And in 2018, he was on an interview and stated that 33 million people could die from a pandemic that was coming to the world and America, as we're part of the world, and that everyone would have to be vaccinated or else, because they had no choice. He's not even a scientist or a doctor or an elected official. He was a computer geek and made a lot of money. And suddenly he became the dictator over our bodies and our minds and our jobs and our way of life. And he's donated to CDC and to WHO millions and millions of dollars, to universities such as Cornell. He has a hall there named after him. You can go on and on. He's donated to NIH for research, where Dr. Fauci has been director for decades. So you can go on and on and on. And Dr. Fauci started warning us about there are bigger surprises coming, bigger variants coming. We're going to be surprised, blah, 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 blah. So here we are. We've got this pandemic out here that have destroyed jobs because CDC and WHO and Fauci were given the rein to lock down our country when they can only give recommendations. No one had to lock down our country. No president, vice president, or Congress member or senator needed to lock down our country. And they didn't need to become our doctors, the one world doctors for everybody. We have our own personal doctors. We were denied access to our own doctors, to our own dentists. Couldn't even go get your teeth cleaned unless it was an emergency. Think about what they did to our country. They enslaved us. They held us hostage. They indefinitely detained us. And now they're calling us domestic enemies, deplorables, ignorant, small-minded, anything that demeans anyone who believes in God, who believes in Christianity, who is a patriot, who believes in morals, integrity, principles, values, the American way of life, sovereignty, legal immigration, legal vetting required by state and federal law, legal citizen, which requires assimilation as an American and to assimilate as an American and be loyal and uphold and swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. We don't have that. We have 30 million plus and still flooding into our nation of foreigners from around the country who are unidentified, never show up for court, scattered around our country, and they used our tax dollars to do it. And then they told us that we must be jabbed, but they don't have to, that we are a danger, and Dr. Fauci says they are not spreaders, they don't spread COVID. So only the American people spread COVID, according to Dr. Fauci? Are you joking? Are you kidding? So if you take your mask off to go eat, you don't spread COVID. But if you're not eating and you're not drinking, put the mask on because you spread COVID. Ridiculous is this. You're cutting off your oxygen supply when flus, the reason you die from a flu is because you can't breathe. The reason you die from a heart attack is because you can't breathe. Lung disease, all of it. It's because you can't breathe. So what is the first thing the paramedics do? They give you oxygen. So why are they cutting off the oxygen supply needed for healthy cells to survive and for our organs to survive and stay healthy, especially the heart and the brain and the lungs, to keep the immune system strong? God gave us a nose and a mouth to breathe in fresh oxygen and exhale carbon monoxide 24/7 around the clock to do all of these things to keep our bodies and brains and hearts and lungs and ourselves healthy. Chemicals are not natural to the body. That's why they have adverse health effects on the body. In many cases, as we're seeing with the numbers going up with people who are post-vaxxed and find themselves in the hospital, especially children with heart inflammation, which is pretty scary because two kids were with their family in a pharmacy and discount store. And they reported to have been inadvertently jabbed, two kids, and they ended up with heart problems. So we have to be really careful about being human lab rats for profit, for big pharma, who has absolutely no liability whether you die or you're disabled for life. So you have a choice. It's like Russian roulette. And here's what Dr. Anthony Fauci said, NIAID director of NIH and NIH director. The availability, if we have more than one successful candidate, which is a human lab rat, which is a volunteer generally in the past. It was a volunteer who was willing to be a volunteer, who's explained what was in the injection or the drug, whatever they were researching and developing. And they're usually paid, willing volunteers. And then they're told the risk of being disabled or dying. And then they're also asked to sign a consent form. And those are the former FDA regulations for being a human lab rat in America. But they're not implementing that. Why not? Because Dr. Fauci says the availability, if we have more than one successful candidate, we also, as the chairman mentioned, will be producing vaccines at risk, which means we'll be investigating considerable resources in developing doses even before we know of a candidate or candidates if it works. And he says, I must warn that there is also the possibility of negative consequences, where certain vaccines can actually enhance the negative effects of the infection. The big unknown is efficacy. Will it be present or absent? And how durable will it be? Think about what those words just, what he just said. And he was talking to his colleagues. And I guess this video got leaked online. And finally, I want to mention the NIH has launched a public-private partnership called Accelerating COVID-19 Therapeutic Interventions and Vaccines. Now, why would they launch a private and public partnership? Is it with Pfizer, Moderna, and BioNTech? Because it's alleged online that BioNTech was purchased by George Soros and Bill Gates, and that alleged that Pfizer and BioNTech has partnered, and that they are sharing the profits from all the jabs. Well, they have a built-in customer base if they mandate that everyone must be jabbed against their will or lose their jobs. Where in the Constitution, which Constitution are they reading? Where in the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights does it state that a president of the United States or a billionaire or billionaires or Wall Street CEO employers can fire people, play doctor, fire people, order them to get an experimental trial injection that Dr. Fauci says is high risk and has unknown efficacy, so they don't know what the consequences are to you as an individual when you get jabbed, whether you're okay or whether you'll be dead and immediately or down the road, or if you'll be disabled for life and won't be able to work anyway. If you die or if you're disabled, you still won't be able to work. But where in the Constitution, which constitutional laws are they applying to mandate that every person on the planet be their built-in customer and that they are allowed to control your body and your mind with the alleged intent of hooking you up to the internet and turning you into a zombie through 5G and other AI devices that they've already developed or are in the works of developing, and you will be a mindless zombie who does not think for themselves if you survive these lab tests as a case study for Big Pharma and for artificial intelligence and for Wall Street profit. Or for Wall Street profitability. You are a human commodity for profit as human capital. So just wanted you to think about that and about the semiconductors, because the semiconductor chip shortage first got the boardroom sweating around February, when the average order to delivery times for chips stretched to an unprecedented 15 weeks because of a confluence of factors. A pandemic-induced economic slump prompted car makers to prematurely slash chip orders, which soon rebounded as chips were hoarded by firms that feared being embroiled in the United States-China trade and technology war. Amid what was described as a global chip shortage, more chips were being sent to factories than were leaving them in products, meaning there are people definitely accumulating chips who knows where in the supply chain, says Liu. To fix things, Liu ordered his team to triangulate different data points to decipher which customers were truly in need and which were stockpiling. We are learning to because we didn't have to do this before, says Liu. It forced him into tough decisions to delay orders for valued customers whose immediate need was judged to be less acute. Sometimes customers may not be satisfied, but we must have to do what's best for the industry. The crisis sharpened focus on access to technology that the United States invented and still designs better than anyone else, but doesn't manufacture at scale anymore. Imagine that. Taiwan and China are making the microchips, and Taiwan owns the market worldwide, and we are dependent on them to operate medical supplies, military supplies, cars, home products, you name it. Our country is dependent on those two foreign nations. And you want to know why there's not going to be any toys for Christmas? Because the Democrats and the rhinos sold us out when Bill Clinton not only opened the borders, but globalized our country and outsourced our manufacturing jobs, which includes the semiconductors, the chips that we cannot get in supply to run our country. Taiwan is the largest chip maker in the world. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, world's largest contract manufacturer of semiconductor chips, otherwise known as integrated circuits or just chips that power our phones, our laptops, our cars, our watches, our refrigerators, our military, like I said, vehicles, you name it, medical equipment that need chips. Cars need the chips. So how advanced are we, or are we going back to basics in America? Should you keep your car, your used car, because these manufacturers, major manufacturers of auto in the auto industry are not able to get enough chips to finish the manufacturing of their vehicles from Taiwan or China. So these presidents, vice presidents, congressional members, and senators who are 30% are invested in Big Pharma in the Senate, 20% are invested in the Congress, and how many presidents are invested in Big Pharma, Taiwan, and China's semiconductor chips on the stock market, on Wall Street, in America, who made us dependent on China and Taiwan? Why are those barges out in the ocean? I see them all the time. Why are they just sitting there out in the ocean? Well, people better wake up in America. If you want to read an article called Silicon Alley, it's by Charlie Campbell, and it's in the Time magazine. and Americans better wake up and start contacting their congressmen and their senators and asking them about the barges and asking them about why we're getting rationed and denied food again and products, and why is China and Taiwan making all of the semiconductors needed for all the products and equipment we use in America, and why aren't we manufacturing them in our own country? Well, God bless you. I hope you have a blessed day, and I hope you call your congressman at 202-225-3121. That's 202-225-3121. And some questions and demand answers, because what we are seeing happening in our country is not American. It is not upholding the United States Constitution. And this is not the change and transformation that we need in America. The change and transformation was snake oil that Obama and his team promised in 2009, when they got trillions of dollars. They got trillions of dollars, and they couldn't produce 350,000 infrastructure jobs, and they couldn't manufacture semiconductor microchips for America. Think about that. Talk to you next Wednesday, noon to 1 p.m. God bless you. And stay healthy, stay happy, and remember, injustices can happen to you, and they can happen to me, but together we can make a positive difference. Remember, you're never alone when you tune into The Rose, Colombo Chronicles Live.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.